I get to be on the other side of the mic with the curtains, Adventures of an Undertaker in Training. Tom Jokinen is the author, and it's one of those books that you'll never forget. You'll drive past a funeral home tomorrow, and after you've read this book, you'll know so many more things than you've ever thought you'd ever even perhaps want to know about how the funeral business runs. But you know, it's an interesting mirror on the rest of society, not to mention the best way to keep yourself from getting ripped off. There's all sorts of reasons to consider what's behind the curtain. Coming up next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Again, it almost seems like we have to do this every week, but I just want to make sure I got it pronounced right. Tom Jokinen, correct?
That's right.
Okay, good. You know, and that's enough. That's a lot of pressure to be a guy named Tom Jokinen. You'd better be funny. You spend everybody's making puns about joking, and you better be ready for that.
Well, you know, it comes in stride. Jokinen's a Finnish name, right? So my people are Finns. We got that kind of Nordic bleakness, a bit of a dark streak, and maybe that's one of the reasons why I wound up in a funeral home. They say that the only time a Finn knows true joy is when he's imagining his own funeral, picturing who's going to be there, and so on.
I live in Minnesota. There's a few Finns around
here.
There's
a few Finns in Minnesota.
Although they're third-class citizens behind the Swedes and the Norwegians. It's the one group that the Swedes and Norwegians can agree to look down on, I think, are the Finns somehow.
Oh, well, yeah, maybe there's a little bit of imperial history there that still needs to be ironed out.
I've never quite figured out that pecking order, but I know that the Swedes and Norwegians are making jokes about each other, and they're the same jokes. They just switch names in there. Anyway, the book is Curtains, Adventures of an Undertaker in Training. Tom Jokinen, and tell me about your radio career a little bit. I understand you've been producing for years, and you were working for the CBC when you decided to up and quit and become an Undertaker in Training.
That's right. I probably about 12 years off and on working for CBC and local and national radio, a national current affairs show called Morningside with Peter Zosky a few years back. Then I produced a morning show, a local morning show in St. John's, Newfoundland, which was a great place to live, right on the very east coast of Canada.
Sure.
On the island of Newfoundland. Did some television with News World, which is sort of the CNN equivalent in Canada, All News Network.
Yeah, we already took this. Is they already stole the C for CNN? You didn't really leave much of a choice, did it?
No,
it couldn't be the Canadian News Network. It just wouldn't look like you were copying. So
I think it's now CBCNN.
is that what it is?
No, really, it's it just rolls off the tongue.
Just keep throwing consonants at it till you get it right.
That's right.
You don't go into a ton of details, but you sort of allude to the fact that you are just going to become an undertaker in training and like your friends kind of questioned you about it. Was that a serious adventure career change, or was it just something you thought as a lark, this would make a great book?
Well, I think it lived somewhere in between. It certainly struck me as a good idea for a book, but, I had to take seriously whether I wanted to do a survey piece, you know, kind of just report on it, have a peek, interview a few people, compile some information, research online, and or whether I really wanted to commit to it and live and breathe the world for a while. That was the decision that got me to the crossroads of, am I willing to give up my job in order to do it? And you know, this was a complicated decision, but I thought, this is not something that anyone's really done before, reported from the inside of the funeral industry, which is a very dark and mysterious place on purpose.
Yeah.
That's the nature of our relationship with undertakers, is we have some trepidations about confronting death in modern society. And so we subcontract it all to a profession to take care of. And you know, there's good and bad reasons for that. But it certainly, since Jessica Mitford wrote her famous muckraking book back in the early 60s about the funeral industry, there's been a fairly tense relationship between the funeral world and journalists. But I lucked into, I found this, I had done a documentary for CBC on some of the more unusual funeral trends, and had met this man named Neil Bardell, who is a third generation undertaker. His father, his grandfather was the first embalmer in Manitoba in Western Canada, immigrant from Iceland. Through this documentary, we had had conversations, and I had said to him, you know, I think there's more to this world than I can get by scratching the surface in a TV doc. What if I came to work for you for a while? And I was shocked when he said, sure, why not? I think it's about time that we opened up the windows and let some air in and let people see what really goes on here. So if it hadn't been for Neil and the fact that he was willing to take me on, this would never happen.
Well, let's go back to the that book you're talking about, the Jessica Mitford book, The American Way of Death, which has two versions, one in the early 60s, and then it was revised in the 1990s, just before she died.
Yeah.
This was a book which was originally, she was an academic, right? She
was. I mean, she was a reporter dilettante, you know. She was very British and was a friend of Evelyn Waugh's, who had written a book called The Loved One, a novel set in a cemetery in California, not by name, but by fact, Forest Lawn Cemetery in Los Angeles.
Right.
They both had a kind of a British disdain for American culture and particular American death ways. They sort of thought of it, it was a little bit absurd and tasteless, and we're trying to poke fun at it. Evelyn Waugh through his fiction, but Jessica Mitford through investigating the people that worked in the funeral industry and exposing what really goes on there.
And that changed everything, because when the book came out, it was a huge hit, and what it allowed people to do for the first time is really get an idea of how much, well, I'll just say it, how much they were getting ripped off. That there was a lot of these business practices of upselling and high pressure sales that were going on that we now know sort of take for granted. But at the time, as you said, you know, so many of these businesses sort of operated in the shadows, in the sense that people didn't want to know a lot about them. And as a result, in that it's somewhere in that amnesia that, you know, they were not even going to think about all of this. We don't even want to know about our history. These groups were able to thrive and create these systems where it was all about the profit, huge profit.
Yeah, no question. It was for Jessica Mitford, she had been invited to do some writing on this. She thought, well, why, you know, what's the big deal with undertakers? Why pick on them? But her husband, Bob Truhaft, was a labor lawyer, and he worked with working people. And he was the first one to say to her, look, here's my experience when union members die. Okay, they've worked hard to build up collective agreements with their employer and get some benefits, including death benefits. So somebody works in a factory all his life. He gets a certain amount of money in death benefits. If he happens to die, you would think that that money properly goes to the widow to deal with the fact that her, the main breadwinner in the family, is now gone. But in fact, without much variation, the exact amount that the death benefit works out to is what the funeral director is charging for the funeral. And there can't be a coincidence here. So she said, well, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of it that way. And that's when she launched into the project. But yeah, what she was saying was people were being taken advantage of because they didn't know they didn't have experience in purchasing funerals. I mean, it's like, you know, when you go to the grocery store, not to pay $10 for a tomato, because you buy tomatoes all the time. You go to a funeral home and somebody tells you that the casket costs $8,000. Does that sound high to you or low? Right. I mean, who knows?
Right. And it's the type of workmanship, too, where we'll get into more of this as we talk about the book Curtains, Adventures of an Undertaker in Training with Tom Jokinen, that a lot of this material is sort of like, it's very expensive, and one-time use. I mean, it's intended for a quick little show, and then you either burn it or bury it. And yet it comes at it this enormous markup to the person who is grief-stricken and probably not in their best mind to shop.
That's what Jessica Mitford was saying. There was some, I mean, amongst the critiques of Jessica Mitford's work, which sort of put the family in the position of being too addled by grief to deal with a proper commercial transaction, was maybe that wasn't the case. Maybe there was more social pressure than being sort of confused by grief. It's a taboo subject, right? I mean, it's not something that people talked openly about then, and I would, you know, arguably don't talk as openly about now as, well, certainly more so, but it's still a taboo. If you feel like you're being ripped off, it's not something that you discuss openly because it's embarrassing and shameful.
Right.
This is why things happen in private, between undertaker and family, or used to for sure, that weren't discussed. And that's why her book was it's sort of like took the cork out of the bottle and gave people permission to finally say, yeah, that's my experience too. I just spent $10,000 on a funeral and I don't know how that came about.
How did we get there? And as an undertaker in training, I want to get into some of your experiences and some of the things you've learned. One of those things is not surprising, and that's something I had heard many times, is that people would buy, and just true, false, still goes on, no, people would buy caskets for somebody who was going to be cremated. And so they would give a whole casket, which would then end up getting burned.
Look, cremation has changed everything, and I'm sure we'll get into it. Because cremation has had an incredibly liberating effect in giving people the power to work out their ritual and even to take it away from the funeral industry, for better or worse, because you're not burying a body right away in the ground in a casket. The thing is, there are certain cultural groups, certain families that have traditions where viewing the body at a funeral is still very important.
Very important. But burning the casket, I mean, to get a beautiful coffin to view the body, I get that. But then to turn around and then in some cases we're talking about, you know, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 literally going up in smoke in 24 hours since the purchase. I mean, I can't think of any parallel for that. It's short of gambling in Vegas or something where that much money can go in that fast a period of time.
Well, if you want to buy a casket, the thing is, it is a one-use object. And nobody except a corrupt funeral director, and history shows us that there are a few of those, but in my experience, it's not something I've ever seen, who would reuse a casket once somebody's bought it. The thing is, you bought it, it's going, and you want to cremate, it's going into the retort, which is what they call the cremation oven, whether you like it or not. There are plenty of funeral homes, including the corporate chains, who offer rental caskets to get around this problem. You want to have the body on display, and you want it in a casket. Well, we can rent you a casket, which is like an outer shell. It looks like a traditional casket, but in fact, it has a trap door at the end, and inside is a multi-density fiberboard box in which the body is contained, and that pulls out. It's like a fake inside that pulls out for the cremation, and the shell of the casket survives for another day.
And that's really, I mean, I just, again, to speak to our funeral practices and what has changed and what should change still, the idea that anybody at any time to have spent thousands of dollars on something that's going to get turned around and going to get burned, it just doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense in terms of resources. It doesn't make any sense for lots of reasons other than it became a kind of standard. And that was sort of that was something that I remember reading about as a kid and thought, oh, my God, this is just what a waste to do that, especially with families that just may have lost, as you said, the primary breadwinner. And all of that money is being spent on this big last grand party. It's sort of like those princess weddings you hear about that cost $100,000 and the couple is divorced in a year. You're thinking, wow, that was a lot. I hope that party was really worth it. But you going undercover as an undertaker in training, you see a lot of things that you comment on in the book, which I find to be very informative. And I think helpful for people, especially if they're not in grief right now, to read the book Curtains so that they're better prepared when that day should come that they have to walk into or choose to walk into a funeral director's office.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it wasn't undercover. I mean, I made it clear to the people that I was working with what I was doing there. So it was, you know, I took notes. It was, it wasn't a secret. And then, in fact, you know, they, within a short time sort of forgot that I was, there as a writer and remembered that I was there as an extra body to, you know, be able to send out to fill up the hearse with gas or vacuum the visitation room or do all the Joe jobs that somebody that an apprentice does in a funeral home. So, which is what I did, as well as, you know, cremating the dead and being involved in their embalming and dressing the dead and getting involved in arrangements with families and assisting at funerals, all that an apprentice does is what I did.
I read the book and it's great. And the stories you tell about, for example, learning to dress a body that's already been dressed and then the conflict that exists in the industry over putting whole clothes, including underwear, on bodies, as opposed to the cutaway clothing with the slit up the back, which I thought was industry standard, that you would do that all the coats and all the shirts had slits up the back or the pants for that matter.
It's a matter of style in a way. You know, you go to any profession and people have different ways of doing things based on how they're brought up or how they learned. There are clothes cutters and non-clothes cutters in the funeral industry. And in fact, they used to sell in Jessica Mitford's time, they used to sell special cutaway clothing, you know, that was suits and dresses and pants and shoes even designed for the dead. So the shoes opened up in the back and gave what the advertisers would describe as a more comfortable fit for the corpse.
Comfortable fit.
but you know, people that send clothes to have their loved one dressed in for a funeral, there are some undertakers who, because people change in death, or they change just before death, either they gain weight or lose weight, and maybe the clothes don't fit as well as they used to. They will cut the back of a shirt collar or cut a shirt right down the back or a suit jacket right down the back in order to achieve what they consider a more relaxed look. And then there are other undertakers that I worked with who will simply not do that because they don't find it dignified and take a very strong position on it.
Yeah, which is an interesting point you make in the book Curtains, Adventures of an Undertaker in Training, that you talk about dignity when it comes to the body and how sometimes you could even look at that as a wee bit ironic in light of what the body goes through during the course of being prepared for the funeral. We'll talk about that coming up. We'll also talk about the changes in the way in which cremations are being done and the future of funerals on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So in the reviews here for the book Curtains, Adventures of an Undertaker in Training, the description says, more surprising than 6 feet under and even funnier and more illuminating than Stiff, that great book from Mary Roach. We had her on talking about that. And it really is true. It's just a terrific book. Curtains, Tom Jokinen will talk about this coming up in just a second. How cemeteries and funerals, according to the way French historian Philippe Arias sees it, are social constructs to keep nature, the hostile world of worms and decay, separate from a civilized life of flat screen TVs and microwave chapatis. He goes on to say, for the most part, we pulled it off. There are only two weak spots where chaos sneaks in. Wild, wet, and savage, reminding us we're doomed animals. And that's in sex and death. So we devised taboos to deal with the former and to take away its power, and ritual to weaken the chaotic impact of the latter. We'll talk about that. Ritual and death and how that's changing, from a guy who was an undertaker in training, coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So in order to write about the industry, he joins the industry as an undertaker in training. Tom Jokinen, probably the, I mean, I read a lot of The American Way of Death by Jessica Mitford. I read a lot of it in the revised form that came out in the 90s, and actually had attempted to get in touch with her as soon as the book was reissued. And I thought, oh, this would make a great interview, only to find out that she had passed on. And I was so disappointed, but I still read through a lot of the book, and I was glad that somebody sort of picked up the mantle and continued the discussion, as we will tonight on Coast to Coast. So you did something which she didn't do. I mean, she just wrote about it, and she went and she did some sort of investigative reporting along with her husband, where they would go to funeral homes and they would ask funeral directors questions. And I got a kick out of the fact that Julie Andrews, the Julie Andrews?
Julie Andrews, the actress, and Bob Truhaft, Jessica Mitford's husband. Yeah, they pretended they were a couple going to bury their late aunt, and they went to Forest Lawn Cemetery. So all the research in the book about Forest Lawn was conducted by Bob Truhaft, Jessica Mitford's husband, and Julie Andrews, the actress. And
that's so weird.
maybe there's something there about how funeral directors are or are not tapped into popular culture, that I don't know if Julie Andrews was wearing a veil, but
yeah, you would have thought
pretty
they were
famous at the time. Nobody recognized
already.
Her.
I know already. And yet you did one step further by going to work in this business, and with somebody who is friendly with the idea of you revealing the things that were happened and some of the conversations that take place. And I think it's great. Let's talk about just so we can wrap up the at least some of the discussion about funeral practices. What percentage do you think, and I don't know if it's different in Canada than the United States or what you know, how many people still practice the traditional burial, you know, sort of the 2-day process of the open viewing, and then, you know, everybody gets together and goes through one night, and then then people write remembrances and stuff, and then the next day there's the funeral, and then everybody goes out to the cemetery. How often is that still practiced? Any idea?
It does vary. Where I was in Manitoba, over 50% of all the families that we dealt with were asking for cremation as the method of disposition. So that puts traditional earth burial into the minority. That's true in a lot of urban centers in Canada and the United States. It's even higher on the West Coast. In Vancouver, it's over 60%. On Vancouver Island, it was over 90% of all families dealing with death were choosing cremation. And I think that's a combination of cultural norms, it's a very high Asian population, and also space. There's just simply not the cemetery land available in Vancouver Island. California is a high cremation zone, as are the Sunshine Belt states, Arizona, Florida, where a lot of seniors live. What happens there is people have retired away from home. So what they want when they die is to be cremated and have their ashes sent home by mail or courier. So they may live in Arizona or they may live in Fort Myers, Florida, and die there, but home is still in Wisconsin or North Dakota or something. So you've got that Sunshine Belt where you've got that is where especially the corporate funeral homes have set up shop, because it's a high you know, there's a lot of seniors that live there.
Sure.
And then in the southern U.S., you've still got a lot of traditional, you know, cremation is relatively low. In Atlantic Canada, it's relatively low. So you can kind of map it out and look at the cultural differences and see where tradition still sticks and where cremation is simply taking off.
I maintain that I think there have been more people now whose ashes have been dropped at Wrigley Field in Chicago than that at the memorial of the beach in Normandy. I mean, I swear there's just people I know more. I just got an email from somebody tonight who said that she was going to be taking her ashes back to her mother, wanted to be buried at Wrigley Field. And they don't like to show that on television. And they often will pan away for it. And the guards, if they catch you doing it, will arrest you. But that lots of people sort of surreptitiously bring their ashes to different places. And I now have a name for it, thanks to your book. And that's wildcatting, right?
Wildcat scattering. Yeah, I didn't invent that. Stephen Prothero coined it for a book on cremation called Purified by Fire. But it's also an industry term, wildcat scattering. So you see people taking their ashes to Wrigley Field or other places which have meaning for the person who died. It happens in Disneyland. You know, somebody will board the Pirates of the Caribbean ride and scatter cremated remains halfway through the ride. Disney denies this. They just say it simply doesn't happen. Certainly there's been a fair share of reporting, interviewing, so-called cast members or the kids who work the rides. Right. That this goes on all the time. Choosing a spot that has meaning and permanence in the same way a grave might. It's certainly open to discussion whether you want to be scattering yourself on the Pirates of the Caribbean ride and they have to stop the ride and send in the janitorial staff to vacuum you up with a HEPA filter and dispose of you in the garbage, which is what inevitably happens. Doesn't offer a whole lot of permanence. Also is a question of whether you want to impose your cremated remains on your fellow Disneyland goers, whether that's the proper thing to do. A little bit of discretion and magic and sobriety is sometimes preferred to scattering your ashes so that other people are breathing it in and sneezing. You talk about this idea of permanence. Plenty of people scattered at Yankee Stadium because they figured, well, Yankee Stadium's always going to be there. Wouldn't that be nice to be there forever?
And they it's not. Yeah, but they were happy when it was still up. They were happy, and it doesn't surprise me. Disney. Disney still denies that people lift up their shirt during the Magic Mountain ride, right? With that little photos taken. So they'll catch on. You know, that is the interesting thing about remains, and that it actually is illegal to dispose of remains anywhere you want, or cremains, as the business calls it. And that you even the restrictions on you can't just you or really shouldn't just be tossing them out windows of low-flying planes, or you have to go. You can't just, empty something at the end of a pier. Technically, you're supposed to go out to, 12 miles or something?
It depends. You know, it's state by state, and some are less explicit than others. I think really what it comes down to, if you want a kind of a global view of how the law looks at scattering cremated remains, is it's very much a don't ask, don't tell kind of practice. I've never heard of anybody arrested for littering, for scattering cremated remains in a national park or a forest or a mountain or a stream. But certainly there have been opportunities for commerce to take advantage of the fear that you're doing something naughty. California probably has the toughest law. I mean, it used to be illegal to scatter, explicitly illegal to scatter. That's since changed. But they need to, the state wants to register it. And there are companies that will scatter on your behalf and are registered as cremation scattering agents with the state.
Remains
up in an airplane, charge you a chunk of money to scatter outside, through the window of the airplane, and then charge you an extra $1,000 or whatever. Take a DVD of it so you can watch the scattering at home, or they'll take you out to sea, a place with meaning. And this is just a reminder that in this great continent of ours, culturally Canada and the United States are so similar, you can always hire somebody to do something.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and in this case, too, both in Canada and the United States, there are a lot of people who believe that working with the dead or dealing with the dead is necessary in the way in which it's been done, because it's a matter of public health, that you have to have these sort of antiseptic funereal practices, or we would be having these major outbreaks of diseases. And that's just not true, right?
It's controversial, and there's evidence that going back as far as Jessica Mitford's book in the early 60s, she talked to pathologists who said, you basically can't catch anything off a dead body. And the reason for that is the dead don't sneeze. The dead sneeze, you might have a chance of catching some sort of airborne pathogen. But just by touching a body, no different than touching any other surface, it's not particularly dangerous. So this idea that embalming a body is a measure to protect the public health is a bit of a myth. It's an aesthetic issue, frankly. If you're going to look at, view a body 3 or 4 days after it's died in a funeral home, there might be an argument to embalm the body because of how it's going to look. But that's a whole other discussion. Doing it for the sake of the health of the people who are going to be there is just simply the wrong way of looking at it.
We're talking with Tom Jokinen, the author of Curtains, Adventures of an Undertaker in Training. Occasionally we'll make reference to the seminal work by Jessica Mitford called The American Way of Death, so we understand there's kind of two books in discussion, although Curtains is the book that Tom has written. But back to that idea about handling death and death practices, I don't know what it's like in Canada, but in many states in the United States, one of the strongest political lobbies in terms of how well-financed it is and often how well-represented it is, is the funeral business, that so many state representatives come out of the funeral business in a lot of states. It's disproportionate, the number of funeral directors or funeral-directed families have members that are, state legislators. And while it's great that, they're doing a civic duty by running for office, et cetera, it also led frequently to these sort of lopsided laws that were in favor of funeral homes, and kind of created some of this mythology that we're talking about, that somehow this is a public health issue. Because for a long time, funeral practices tended to be much more organic, and that families that could afford it, a home, would have a parlor in the front part of the house, which a lot of these older homes still have these wonderful parlor rooms, which were intended to be where body viewings were. If somebody died, you had the casket in the house and people came to the house, and there was nothing wrong with that then. Did you ever look into that?
Yeah, the fellow I worked with, Neil Bardell, called that the village model. Yeah. So when somebody died or was dying, then the village took care of them, the family and the neighbors. People died at home. People died certainly with more frequency 100 years ago, death was more accessible, if you want to put it that way, because it was so ever-present. But they didn't die in a hospital. They died at home, and then the family took care of them, maybe with some help from the community, washing the body at home, dressing, laying it out for a wake, inviting people to come over and pay last respects, lifting the body into a casket was inevitably made at home and carried to the burial ground and buried. And it was only later that, as with so many things that were done at home, that an industry developed to take some of the heat off the family.
What year was that? What year did things start to get weird?
Well, it was the early part of the 20th century. You had homes, you were trying to recreate the idea of the parlor where you wake the body in a funeral home. So then what evolved was this design where, and I've always found it really uncanny, the experience of walking into a funeral home and seeing this faux living room environment, right, with the furniture that nobody ever sits on,
right,
and inevitably the pictures on the wall in which there are no people, there are always paintings of empty boats and that sort of thing. And it's incredibly clean. Who keeps their house as clean as a funeral home? It's just a little bit too inhuman in a way.
Right.
But that's to replicate the experience of dealing with the body at home. Now, where I worked, they were kind of trying to break away from that peculiar tradition of pretending that you were in somebody's house. And it was a much more, the environment to me was much more like a common room in a community college. You know, it was some scattered furniture, plenty of natural lighting. It wasn't meant to pretend it was anything other than a gathering place for this occasion.
That idea, I mean, if you go back into some of these old towns, and I always love to see that when they originally were called funeral parlors, and that was, they were these old mansions that were often converted to be just, you know, sort of the 24/7 facility, and that there would be people like you had been that would live there around the clock, would live in, you know, usually the apprentice or somebody would live upstairs in a special apartment to be there for the reception of bodies and everything. And there's something wrong with that. I don't mean to indict it like there's, you know, like it's really crazy, but it led to kind of a crazy period where we thought, and really until the last couple of years, I think, honestly, there was still this belief that these were centuries old practices. And they aren't. They were a recent, fairly recent industry that flourished for a period of time and is already in a kind of disillusion. That a lot of these mom and pop places started selling out to corporations a long time ago. Talk about, until we get to the top of the hour here, the type of corporations that are at work and what do they really own?
There are not as many corporate-owned funeral homes as there once were, is the short answer. But there are big conglomerates like SCI, Service Corporation International, headquartered out of Houston, which own about 2,000 funeral homes and cemeteries in Canada and the United States, more in the U.S. than in Canada. And there are plenty of others. Stewart, there's a group in Canada called the Arbor Group, which own chains of funeral homes. They bought up a lot of mom-and-pop funeral homes in the late 90s. There was a feeding frenzy, and many would say that they overpaid for a lot of those properties. And then the bubble burst. Inevitably, when there's a rush, the bubble bursts. That's the way it works. And the same thing happened to the funeral industry. They were dealing with overpriced, was paying too much for these funeral homes, piling up debt, and then magically it was the death rate seemed to plummet.
How is that possible?
Well, look, I mean, people, you're relying on a fairly steady stream of raw materials, if you will.
Right.
People that were born in the Depression, there weren't as many. So it was kind of a natural, they were coming of age, and it was kind of a natural dip.
Well, you think they would have been able to see that on a flow chart somewhere when they were going through all these corporate buy-ups. We'll get back to that then.
Okay.
And then the other thing that changes is the proliferation of crematories, these retorts that are going around the clock too, and people change their practice. 98% of people in Japan cremate the dead. 98% are cremated. That's just one of the many interesting facts. In Curtains, Adventures of an Undertaker in Training, Tom Jokinen has written a funny, very entertaining book, but very interesting at the same time. We'll get to that coming up about what exactly is the future of funereal practices, and for that matter, how is cremation changing everything next on Coast to Coast? This is Ian Punnett.